that mature Christians are going to be patient in times of trouble, through trials and difficulties. We saw that in chapter 1. In chapter 2, he tells us that they will practice what they preach, that the actions that we do will indicate where our faith is. That he said that faith without works is what? Dead. Yeah. See, you guys were listening. That's good. Faith without works is dead. It isn't faith and works. It isn't faith or works, but it is faith that works. He says words without action are meaningless. And so it's interesting as we head into chapter 3 that he begins to talk about the tongue, about the things that we say, the words that we use. And so what's the connection here? He just got through saying that it's about our deeds and not about what we say, and now he's going to say, yeah, well, the words, no, they're important. The connection is that real faith is demonstrated in our actions, but it's also demonstrated in our words and the things that we say. Both demonstrate the Christian faith. Our actions reveal a lot about our faith, but so do the words that we use. Words without action are useless in our spiritual life, but that doesn't mean that the words are not important. They are. Our actions validate our faith, and so do our words, and that's what he's going to say today. So chapter 3, it deals primarily with the tongue, with what we say. I have to admit to you, as we start into this chapter, I don't like it. I don't like it because it convicts me. Every time I read this, it's like, oh, man. So if you feel the pinch today of the word, you're not alone. We're all in this together. Verse 1, he says, "Not many should become teachers, my brothers, knowing that we will receive a stricter judgment. For we all stumble in many ways. If anyone doesn't stumble in what he says, he is a mature man and who is also able to control his whole body." Chapter 3, it starts off saying, not many people should be teachers. We don't need many teachers in the church. We do need teachers, but just not many, he says. And the reason he gives is that because teachers have a higher expectation that is placed on them. The bar for teachers is set higher than it is for everyone else. And that applies to not just what teachers say, but what they do, how they live their life. There is a higher heavenly expectation placed on teachers. It's easy for teachers to say things that people don't like, that people don't agree with. We can say things that offend and cause people to stumble. And it's a challenge. So I have to be careful. When people come to me and say, you know, I don't agree, I don't like, I have to be careful that I don't get into this defensive mode of trying to defend my position. I have to be careful about how I say, what I say, and the way that I say it. You know, am I loving? Am I gracious? Am I merciful in the way that I respond? You know, on every other Friday night we meet for a K group over in the cafe, and if you're not participating in that, I want to encourage you to play a role, but Judy typically comes, Judy Sankey, our keyboard player, and she's probably been here longer than anybody besides Peggy and me. And every so often, she'll turn back to her notes and she'll say, you know, 10 years ago, you said when we were studying this that, you know, and I, every time I start to sweat when she does that, because I'm thinking, oh, what did I say 10 years ago? Oh, man. There's always that challenge. One pastor, and this is a true story, he was in Lebanon in 1983, and if you know anything about your history, Lebanon was in the middle of a brutal civil war back then. And the pastor was given an opportunity to go and speak to a militia group. These were tough guys. They had been fighting against the PLO. They were a part of a political party that was called the Christian something something, but it was Christian in name only. Tough group. When he went in there, they had, you know, machine gun belts, bullets over their shoulders. They were all carrying automatic weapons. These were hardened, battle-tested troops. And he was given a chance to speak to them, to preach to them. And he told them, you know, you need to be ready for eternity. You know, life is short. And these guys knew it. You know, they had friends dying all around them. And he told them they needed to give their life to Christ, and that that meant more than just being a part of a political party. It meant giving their life completely to him, knowing him personally, walking with him, submitting themselves to his authority. And as he closed, he closed with a story. And in this story, there was a dead dog, and the dead dog had a rope around his neck, and this dog was hung on a nail on a wall. And the point of the story, the point he was trying to get across was, you know, you got to give your whole life to Christ. You got to give everything to him. You got to submit to him. It's not just little pieces here and little pieces there, but you got to give everything to the Lord. And as he concluded, he asked the men if they wanted to receive Christ. And, you know, fully in this way, and to his surprise and great joy, every man in the room raised their hand. Man, he was so excited. He prayed for them. He left the village rejoicing that the Lord, thinking the Lord was going to start some kind of a revival in this village. But as he was driving back to the hotel, he began to talk with his interpreter, and he was expressing, you know, his great joy at how these men had responded. But the interpreter said to him, you know, I think you may not have understood completely what was going on back then. You see, those men, they hate the PLO. And they refer to them as dogs. And they were thinking that you were calling them to kill every PLO member they could find, to hang them up on a wall, to string them up, to, you know, to murder them all. Oh, man. They thought that in the name of Christianity, you were calling them to kill every PLO member. And that's what they were saying. Yeah, man, we're all in on that. We're all over that. Well, the pastor, when he heard this, man, he was aghast. He was dumbfounded. He couldn't believe what had happened. He thought he had started a revival, and what he actually did was started a kind of a Christian jihad, you know. And he was just crestfallen. He was really concerned about that, because he just communicated badly. And that can happen. It can happen to any pastor. So pray for me. If you can't think of anything else to pray for me. Ask God, Lord, don't let him say anything dumb today, this time. The instruction that James gives us here, I think in part, is based on the tradition within the Jewish synagogue. They met in the synagogue, and when they came together, any man could get up and begin to speak. They, you know, just people would get up and they would share. It was not in this kind of a setting. It was more of a round table room where everybody sat around, and different guys would get up and speak and talk and share, and you can just imagine how in that kind of a forum things could get sideways pretty quickly. And so James says, we shouldn't have many teachers. You just need to have a few. So the expectations on a teacher are higher. And because some just have wrong motives. There are false teachers today, just like there were false teachers back then. Some teach because they want a following. They want to have people acknowledging them. They want the attention. They want the status. Others just think they have great wisdom. It's just built into them, and they need to share this, and people need to hear everything that they have to say. In a seminary class, I heard this story. It was on preaching, and one of the students was asked to get up and to share, you know, his ability to preach. And after about 5 minutes into his sermon, the professor got up and said, okay, that's it. You're done. You do not have the gift of preaching. And this student was upset. He was bothered because, you know, he was going to seminary to be a preacher. And so he said, look, I know I've been called to preach. And the professor looked at him and said, well, maybe so, but we are not called to listen. There, you know, some people want to be in the pulpit, but they just haven't been given the gift. The church doesn't need a great number of teachers. What the church needs today, most of all, is a great number of servants. People who are committed to serve in the area that God has placed them, wherever God has called them. And guys, that's something that's missing in the church today. I speak of the church in general. I look at you guys, and I know most of you are involved in ministry in some place, and I'm very proud of what God is doing in people's lives here. But what we need people who are committed to serve. We need servants. You know, we live in a service-oriented culture. And by that I mean, whenever we go out, we expect to be served. You go to a restaurant, and they bring you the menu, they bring you your food, they bring you your drink. You expect to be served. I want my plate clean, and I want silverware, and I want this. I expect you to top off my drink, and, you know, we want to be served. We go to the commissary, and we want a grocery store, and we expect them to have the food that we want. I want my meat this way. I want this, and we expect to be served. I went to the exchange last week looking for something there, and I went to the area where this product should be found, but I had some questions, and I'm looking around, and there's nobody there to serve me, and I'm getting mad. What are my tax dollars going for? Where are these people? They should be out here. You know, that's just our mindset. In this culture today, we want to be served. And guys, that mentality is infecting the church. People come to church with the attitude, I'm here, somebody serve me. You're lucky that I'm here. Somebody better do something to serve me. Guys, the church is a place to serve, not a place to be served. We all need to have this attitude. And teachers are just servants like everybody else. That's just the role that they've been given. My advice to anybody who thinks that God is calling them to teach or to preach is to let those opportunities come to you. Let them come to you. Don't chase them down. Don't try to get them in a headlock and, you know, drag them to the ground. If it's God's will for you to teach, that opportunity will present itself. God will open the door when the time is right. Bottom line, and here's what I want you to hear. The mature Christian, guys, has a greater desire to learn than he does to teach. The mature believer has a greater desire to learn than to teach. And one of the lessons we desperately need to learn today is contentment. Just being content. Be content with what God gives you. Be content with where you are. Learn to be content with the role that God has given you. Live a joyous life. Don't try to change things. Don't try to strive for things that God has not provided. Maybe it's not for you, or maybe it's just for later. But learn to live in the moment, in the place where God has you. Learn to be content. Just bask in what the Lord has for you today, what he has for you right now. Find joy in the present. Be content. Well, starting in verse 3, James has some illustrations. He says, Now when we put bits into the mouths of horses to make them obey us, we also guide the whole animal. And consider ships. Though very large and driven by fierce winds, they're guided by a small, very small rudder wherever the will of the pilot directs. And so too, though the tongue is a small part of the body, it boasts great things. Consider how large a forest a small fire ignites. And the tongue is a fire. The tongue is a world of unrighteousness. It's placed among the body, among the parts of the body. It pollutes the whole body, sets the course of life on fire, and is set on fire by hell. James gives us two possibilities for the tongue here. First, it is an instrument that guides. It is an instrument that directs, you know, like the bit in the mouth of a horse. It directs the horse to go right or left or straight ahead. Or like the rudder on a ship that guides a ship from one port to another. It transports people and goods. It benefits many. But the tongue, James says, can also be like a fire. A fire that sets the course of your life on fire, but not in any good way, because this fire that James is talking about is the fire of hell. The tongue, it's a small 20-ounce organ. It helps us to manipulate food and to get it ready for digestion in our body. Many of you are looking forward to using your tongue in the cafe after this for that very purpose. I know you're probably getting hungry now, thinking, is he ever going to end? Is he ever going to finish? I can't wait to get some of that gooey, cheesy lasagna. Yeah, I'm wrapping up. But the tongue also controls speech. And in our speech, the tongue is like the rudder of a ship. It's like the bit in a horse's mouth. And it'll put you on a good path, or it will take you down a road to destruction. You know, words are powerful. One writer noted that it takes, you know, the first 2 years of life to learn how to speak and the next 50 to learn how to be quiet. The tongue is the biggest troublemaker in the church. A pastor had a lady in his congregation who was a notorious gossip. She was always on the phone, talking about this and talking about this and da-da-da-da-da-da. And one day she came to him and she said, you know what, God has convicted me of the sin of gossip. My tongue is getting me in trouble. It's getting other people in trouble. My tongue is just a problem. Well, the pastor was a little bit skeptical because she had done this before. And so kind of guardedly he said, okay, so what are you going to do about it? And she replied with righteous fervor, I'm going to put my tongue on the altar. And he looked at her and he said, I'm sorry, but our altar isn't that big. And then he walked away. Yeah, I love this guy. I want to shake his hand. This is great. You know, he just left her there to think about what she had done and the problems that she had caused. No, this wasn't me. It was somebody else. But both the bit and the rudder, they overcome contrary forces. The bit in a horse's mouth enables the rider to control the great power of this beast. The rudder on a ship, it's small in comparison to the ship, but it allows the pilot to guide it any direction that he wants. But what's required is a strong, experienced hand at the helm and with the bridle. The tongue needs to overcome contrary forces as well. The tongue has got to overcome the old nature. Our old nature, our sin nature that wants to move us in the direction of sin. Our tongue, it needs an experienced hand at the control. You know, Proverbs says that the power of life and death are in the tongue. Power of life and death. It's a powerful thing. So what can we do to govern the tongue, govern our tongue, so that it gives us direction and doesn't steer us into destruction? In Matthew chapter 12, Jesus says this. He says, the mouth speaks from the overflow of the heart. Whatever we're saying, it is a reflection of what's in our heart, what's in us. When Jesus is Lord of the heart, he's going to be Lord of our lips as well. And when he controls the tongue, we don't need to fear saying the wrong thing or even saying the right thing in the wrong way. David prayed this. He said, Lord, set up a guard for my mouth. Keep watch at the door of my lips. Do not let my heart turn to any evil thing. A right heart, guys, that's the key. Our hearts need to be right. And the way that our hearts become right over time is by spending time with Christ in prayer, seeking Him, speaking to Him, asking Him, Lord, help me in this. You know, if you're in a jam, you don't have to close your eyes and get on your knees. You can just speak quietly to Him. Lord, I'm in a jam here. Can you help me out? If you feel pulled into a conversation, just ask God for guidance. Lord, help me with this. I don't know what to do here. I don't know what to say here. Lord, could you just open up the ground and swallow this person? It'll be easier that way. He's done that before, you know. I don't know that He'll do it for you, but just saying. We need to pray. We need to bring these circumstances before the Lord and ask Him, because He will answer. The tongue, it can be ignited by the fires of hell or the fire of heaven. Acts chapter 2. If we spend time in prayer with the Lord, then He is going to give us the words that we need to speak from the fires of heaven. Speak right things, good things. So when you hear gossip, if you feel drawn into a bad conversation, just begin to ask God, Lord, help me with this. Don't engage with them. Don't respond to them. Just stare at them. It will freak them out. They will shut up. They will stop talking. Just stare. Just kind of look at them like, huh? It's great. You watch them start to sweat, you know. It's a good thing. But it just kills that whole conversation. Look at verse 7 and 8. It says, every sea creature, reptile, bird, or animal is tamed and has been tamed by man. But no man can tame the tongue. It is a restless evil full of deadly poison. You know, there are places that you can go today to watch, you know, amazing animals who have been tamed. You can watch killer whales do tricks. And they are amazing creatures. Many years ago, when my daughter was in high school, I took her kayaking up in Vancouver and to see the orcas. And we were out in the ocean, and they were swimming around us. We saw probably 100 of them on that trip. Amazing animals. One went right under our kayak. That'll really make you feel small to see one of those things out in the wild. We can tame this incredible, powerful animal. But you know, the guy who tames the killer whale can't tame his tongue. He'll go home at night and argue with his wife. We tame lions and tigers and bears, oh my, but we can't tame the tongue. The tongue comes with its own cage, and we don't use it. I mean, just have to close your mouth, you know? Comes with its own cage. We can't tame the tongue, but we can, guys, we can control our tongue. You know, if you're at home and you're just having a bad day, you're yelling at the kids and arguing with your wife, you know, I told you to put those things away, just having a bad day, and the doorbell rings and it's somebody from church, and immediately it's, hey, how you doing, brother? Yeah, praise the Lord, good to see you. You know, we can control our tongue, but we can't tame it. To tame it requires something stronger than ourselves. It requires a power that we don't have. We need the Lord to help us tame, to help us discipline our tongue. And God is committed to that. You need to understand, I need to understand that is what God is committed to. He wants that for us. Look at verse 9. It says, we praise our Lord and Father with it, the tongue. And we curse men who are made in God's likeness with it. Praising and cursing come from the same mouth? Oh, my brothers, these things should not be this way. Does a spring pour out sweet and bitter water from the same opening? Can a fig tree produce olives, my brothers, or a grapevine produce figs? Neither can a saltwater spring yield fresh water. You know, certain things are pretty obvious in nature. An apple tree is never going to produce oranges. A freshwater spring is not going to yield salt water. But with man, there is this amazing contradiction. Man is the only thing in nature that is out of order. And James asks us for introspection here. He asks us to consider things, to consider our own lives. A fountain can't give two kinds of water. A fountain can't give, you know, salt water and fresh water. A tree doesn't produce more than one kind of fruit. It produces one fruit. When we go to a well, we expect to find sweet water. When we go to a fig tree, we expect to find figs there, or olives on an olive tree. Nature always reproduces after its own kind. What kind of fruit do you produce? That's the question. If the tongue is inconsistent, then there's a problem in the heart. That's where the problem resides. You know, there was a Christian guy who claimed to be Christian, who got angry at work, and, you know, this string of colorful language came flowing out of his mouth, and he was kind of embarrassed and, you know, said to a friend of his later, you know, boy, I don't know why I said all that. You know, that's just not me. That's not who I am. And his friend wisely said to him, well, you know, it came out of you, so it must be you.